My guest William Powers describes Bolivia as a mecca of environmental innovation. There he ran the Amazon Project, the world's largest rainforest-based program to slow global warming. It required getting the cooperation of multinationals and the indigenous people living in the rainforest. Powers has written a new memoir about this work and the controversies surrounding it called Whispering in the Giant's Ear. He now works with the Friends of Nature Conservancy in Bolivia. The country elected its first indigenous president, Evo Morales, last December. In May, he nationalized the nation's oil industry and is trying to increase state control over other energy resources. The Amazon Project was about working, you know, developing an arrangement between multinationals and environmental interests. Would you explain what the deal was?
Well, the deal was that the Bolivian government would set aside a vast tract of Amazon, 3 million acres, forever. And that the multinationals would agree to help pay to have that happen. And they would do that through the international climate change agreements that have taken place over the past 10 years, where they are able to reduce their emissions to slow global warming through one of two ways. One is by reducing emissions or putting in clean technologies. Those are brown sources. And the other is through green sources or saving rainforests. So this is one of those saving rainforest types of agreements where the net benefit is something like billions of tons of carbon reduced from the atmosphere. And they are able to go ahead and get credits for that.
And can you explain how preserving rainforests can counteract carbon emissions?
Well, you can think of rainforests as a sponge. It sponges carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and releases oxygen. So it's actually very simple. It's a very simple idea. And it's capturing those, what we call in the business, ecological services of what the planet does to maintain our water supply, to maintain our climates, to provide any number of services, including aesthetic values, to monetize it, to give it a monetary value. Basically, we're changing the way that global capitalism works. It's changing the fibers of the global economy in ways that are positive, because you've suddenly made something that was free, like polluting or cutting down a rainforest, not free. Now it has a cost, and that cost causes a different behavior in the part of corporations.
So the cost for polluting is that you have to preserve, in this case, rainforest, because the vegetation in the rainforest will inhale the bad guy carbon dioxide.
That's right. That's
and
exactly
exhale
right.
The good guy oxygen.
And, exactly.
And does this strike you as like, you describe this project in your book as anti-utopian. What do you mean by that?
It's anti-utopian in the sense that it's not relying on the goodwill of companies or governments to do the right thing. It's changing the economy, the global economy. It's changing economics.
So you think of this as a really pragmatic approach in the short term to dealing with the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And you had people who you knew in Bolivia who were basically accusing you of being in bed with the multinationals. They didn't see it as pragmatic. They just saw it as bad. So what was your response to people who you knew who thought that now you were a bad guy too?
Yeah. Well, that's sort of a knee-jerk reaction, that if you're doing something that involves these corporations, it must automatically be bad. And I agree that it's not the only solution. And I don't want people to have a warm and fuzzy feeling about it that, wow, you know, if we just save all the rainforests, we can go on driving two SUVs and burning fossil fuels for the rest of history. And that's not true. I think that you need both sides of the equation. You need to be doing these types of rainforest projects like we did, and you need to be working with multinationals for the financing, unless someone else has a better idea for how to fund it. And the other side of it has to be really focusing on consumption.
When you got to Bolivia, you were told that in the environmental world, the world divided between grapes and watermelons. So who are grapes and who are watermelons?
Okay, well, the watermelons are red on the inside, sort of very left-leaning, progressive, change capitalism, need to destroy capitalism, but green on the outside. That's a one paradigm. The other were the grapes. Those are people who are green through and through. They come at it from a more of a preservationist, conservationist perspective.
And what was the conflict between grapes and watermelons?
Well, the watermelons really felt like you should not be engaging the global economy at all, at least not the corporate version of global economy. And the grapes felt, well, whatever it takes to preserve Mother Nature, even if that means, you know, working with this sort of financing.
So your project was a grape project by these by these standards, yes?
Okay, by that very simple metaphor, yes, I would say it is.
When the anti-global protests started heating up, you became involved in a really interesting protest, and it was a protest about the government claim on a part of the land coming into conflict with the indigenous claim to that same land. Would you describe both parties' claim to that land?
Well, the indigenous people said that that had been their land for generations and generations. That's their ancestral land, that particular rainforest with its waterfalls and barochis and wildlife and everything. It's part of their mythology, part of their way of living, and their history. And the government was saying, no, that land belongs to logging companies through concessions granted 10 years before, and that's the legal claim to the land. So it's really a question of law. And the dispute came down to a clause in the forestry law in Bolivia that does say that original peoples, indigenous peoples who have been on the land for a certain amount of time, have rights to that land that supersedes concessions, particularly if the concessions are not under use. And those concessions were not under use, and the companies were not paying taxes and other issues around it. So the much stronger legal, in addition to the sort of ethical case for the land, went to the Indians.
But the case is still unresolved.
It is.
Now, in protest of the government's claim that this land was part of a logging concession, the indigenous group, in collaboration with your environmental group and in collaboration with the larger park area, came up with a declaration. What did the declaration say?
Well, the declaration said that this was an indivisible territory, what's called the indigenous territory of the Bajo Paraguá, and that couldn't be divided up and that couldn't be annexed off.
So you joined with the indigenous group when it came to protesting the government's claim that this land should be part of a logging concession. But then one of the leaders of this indigenous group said that in protest, if the government insisted on keeping that land for the logging concessions, that the indigenous group was going to go into the big national park, which is the park where you were running your environmental project. They're going to go into this park and claim it as their land in compensation for the land they felt that they were losing. So where did you stand on this? I mean, this is the park that you're using for your project. Mm. How did you feel about them, you know, invading the park?
Well, I have to admit that at first I felt rather betrayed that all the work we'd done, not just since I'd been there from 2002 to 2004 with them, but even before that for years, the relationship that had been built up with that particular indigenous group was strong and solid, and I felt like that's a tactic that I could not accept personally, going into the national park and cutting down the rainforest or annexing it from the national park. At the same time, politics were shifting in Bolivia. This was during the time of Sanchez Gonzalo de Lozada, his government, when Evo Morales and the MAS party was sort of rising in Bolivia. And that group, the Chiquitano Indians, were joining with some of these other social movements in the East. And it had become part of a much larger dynamic where the fight was for land and for territory as the number one issue of indigenous people nationally in the country. And it was sort of a by any means necessary.
So you held your ground in thinking that invading the park was a bad idea.
I did. But then after that was announced and became an issue and actually caused quite a scandal and led to some meetings on the national level with the Minister of Sustainable Development and others, just in informal conversations with the indigenous people, they said it was a tactic. It was a media. It was a way of getting attention, a way of going after what people, in a sense, really care about most, which became sort of obvious in the whole crisis that, you know, there's a real concern for the environment that even outweighed the concern for the indigenous people in the area.
So they never really did invade the park.
They never invaded the park. There was talk of slash and burning a few acres with the TV cameras rolling, but even that never happened.
So were you able to repair your relations with the indigenous group you'd been working with?
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say that they were really that damaged. There's tension like in any relationship, but the relationship did get better after that and continues. But I'm sad to say that they still do not have that indigenous territory as their own. It's still under debate, and I'm hoping now with the big change in the country that 740,000-acre Amazon territory will be legally given over to the Chiquitano Indians.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
William Powers is the author of Whispering in the Giant's Ear. He now works for the Friends of Nature Conservancy in Bolivia.